Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm, the first cheese-making co-op in Vermont. For more information, visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. And it's taken us months upon months, years upon years, to actually make this happen today. Hogan Massoff, a.k.a. SassyRadish.com. We'll ask where that moniker came from in a bit.
Hi.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And quite possibly at your busiest moment, too.
Things are sort of colliding with one another.
It's an amazing path that you've taken, because food writing, amongst so many other things that you do in your life, wasn't kind of on your initial radar. You're a Russian expat.
I am.
And where in Russia, and why expatted?
Well, I was born in St. Petersburg, and my family and I immigrated in December of 88, and at the time, immigration was not straight from Russia or USSR to America. We had to go to Vienna first and stay there for 3 weeks while they processed all our documents, and then we had to go to Italy and stay there for a month while they processed our documents. I'm not sure why.
Yeah.
And then we had a choice to go to either Australia or Argentina or Israel or the U.S. or I think there was another country. And so we decided to go to the U.S. and we decided to come to Boston.
Yeah.
So the reason we left was both of my parents had trouble in Russia as Russian Jews going to college for majors that they wanted to. It's a pretty intolerant country. I'm sure that doesn't strike you as surprising.
Given, we won't even talk about the Olympics.
That could take up half an hour. But they wanted me to have a better future. They wanted me to do whatever it is that I wanted to do and to have a more stable and successful, fulfilling life.
See, it's funny thinking about those paths,
definitely.
Vienna to Italy.
Right.
In retrospect, that is one of the best culinary vacations you can have.
It's true, except we had like $3 to rub together, you know, like they gave us, we couldn't take money with us from Russia at the time. And so we were traveling on Jewish immigration assistance. And so we had so little money that we were like rationing it for food. So I would be lying if I said that I sampled the best of the best.
Yeah.
Although both of those cuisines I'm a huge fan of, especially we were in Rome and Roman food is phenomenal.
So then Boston.
Boston.
Known for its exquisite blank.
Beans. And, well, oysters and lobster and, you know, I think there are a lot of great things. Like, I think, don't quote me on this, but apple pie with cheddar. I think that's sort of a New England thing, which I love. Came to Boston, or rather Boston suburb, right next to Salem, Mass., rich with its own fantastic history. So, so came there, and I started cooking pretty early after. I mean, I cooked when I was a little kid. I was playing around in the kitchen always. I was always drawn to being in the kitchen because I think kitchens is where the action happens and gossip happens and people. It's the family water cooler. But my parents worked pretty long hours and they started working right away or they were taking night classes. And so I sort of started, I took it upon myself to start putting dinner on the table and making it. So I don't even remember what I was cooking at the time. It was very pretty simple, but I started making dinner for a family like pretty nightly.
I mean, as far as Russian cuisine goes, I know there are a lot of soups, hot and cold.
Yes, it's hearty.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hearty. But also, you know, it's funny. There's definitely lovely, very not stick-to-your-ribs kind of things in the summer that you can have. One of my favorite salads that we made in Russia and we make here all the time, that I make here all the time, is cucumber and radish and dill and scallion and parsley, and you put whatever green herb you have, and then you throw a bunch of sour cream on it and put salt on it. It's the simplest thing in the world, and I can eat it. Like, if you make give me a big bucket of it, I will eat it.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
You know, with Middle Eastern cuisine kind of proliferating, and you see things like labneh, fattoush, and people know those. You know, you just move a little further east. It's there too, just with a different name.
And Russians put sour cream on everything.
Yeah.
It's our national condiment.
And pelmeni, is that how you say it?
Oh, yes,
pelmeni.
The meat dumplings.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing.
So, I mean, I know all the things that are kind of pierogi-esque, you know, being at Brighton Beach and going to M&I, which is sadly no longer the international market.
What happened to it?
I think it closed.
Seriously?
I was researching it because I was going to be out there this morning and bring back a treat.
You just completely shattered my worldview.
do not quote me on that, but I did look online before I made a trek out there, and it said it's no longer.
That was quite a store.
Yeah, it
was. Everything and anything was there.
And pickled, you know, watermelon, pickled...
I love pickled watermelon.
Full tomatoes. But, you know, Russian cuisine, for me, my grandma was Romanian, so I kind of got like a subset of that. All that sour, you know, which was... kind of adverse as a child.
Yeah.
And then you moving to Boston, where it's like hearty Americana.
Yes.
There's not much sour. There's a lot of...
Well, I guess there are pickles, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like every culture has its own pickle, because every culture had to figure out how to preserve things at some point, right? You know, you didn't have refrigeration, so... Not as much as in Russian culture. I really think Russians do a lot. I mean, they'll pickle anything.
Yeah.
So it's... I always grew up liking pickled things, but I know none of my classmates when I was in Russia going to grade school liked anything pickled, but I could like eat pickles and tomatoes and watermelon. My mom used to make pickled watermelon.
Yeah. So we're in Boston now.
Still the same area where we settled, which is Lynn, Massachusetts.
Home of Fluff?
Yes. How did you know that?
Oh, I have a little fluff story, which I'll reveal someday. But yeah, you spin
home
around.
Home
I tried to get in the factory one time, and I was disallowed.
No, really? Denied?
Mm-hmm.
Ouch. Yeah, so Home of Fluff, I think that's sort of its current claim to fame. At the time, it was a big shoe capital manufacturing in the country.
Yeah.
Like, turn of the century. So, but yeah, but that's where my family now resides. So
I know from, you know, schooling, education, it wasn't, again, towards food, but more so towards finance.
Yeah.
And Boston is a kind of a financial hub. It's an economic city. It isn't, and I don't mean to chide anyone there, isn't the most creative place.
No. That's, yes, no, it's not. Though there are pockets of creativity, as there are in, I think, other cities. But I gravitated towards... like most children of immigrants, to practical, reliable, stable things that would enable me to, you know, perhaps support my parents when they were older and make sure that I always had a steady job and I always had money in the bank. And when you come to another country, you see that your parents struggle with, you know, culturally struggle with the fact that they're older, they don't speak the language as well, and you think, I never want to wake up in the middle of the night thinking, how am I going to pay rent? And that's sort of, that's something that really shaped the way that I look at the world and how I make a lot of decisions, you know, for better or worse. But I thought that finance was, you know, stable. I wasn't necessarily after the huge paycheck. I wound up falling into the hedge fund realm after college, because at the time when I was graduating, hedge funds were a little bit like the dot-coms. They were nimble, they were small, there was a lot of quick decision-making, and there wasn't a lot of red tape. And so I thought that was really interesting. Now, of course, it's much more institutionalized, and the reputation of hedge funds is not that good. But at the time, it wasn't anything so big and bad. And so I joined, and at first I worked for a couple of investment banks, and then I joined a hedge fund and worked in their marketing department. And I honestly never loved it, and it never fueled my passion. And on any given day, I could not tell you what the Dow would close at, but I could tell you who wrote which magazine, you know, food article, what's the coolest new ingredient that I was experimenting with, what cookbook I just purchased, things like that. Like, I could talk to you about that for a couple hours at least, but I just couldn't for the life of me really become passionate about finance. And I think I was okay at it, but I don't think I was ever good at it. But it's partly because I didn't really care for it.
So when do you take that leap of faith? I know Sassy Radish has actually been blogged for some time now.
It's been around for a while.
2005?
Yeah. And I didn't quite focus on it that much. When I started it, it was more like just a creative outlet, just to document what I was doing, you know, cooking-wise. I didn't really think about doing anything with it long-term. But so in 2008, when the markets fell and things got really, really dicey, where I was working, we lost quite a bit of money because we were invested in Asian markets fell. And I just remember thinking, this is not a place for me. It's really hard. It's just really hard to justify, while the rest of the country was struggling to pay bills, everybody on Wall Street was complaining that they weren't getting a big enough bonus.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point or another, I just said, I can't, this isn't computing in my head, and I can't sell something I don't believe in, really. So I started to think about it more, and in February of 2011, I took that leap, and my now husband and boyfriend was very, very supportive and encouraging, and I think he, like, kept egging me on and said,
yeah,
do it, it's your life, you're going to look back and regret things that you maybe didn't try, but will you really regret things that you have tried? And so I knew our fund was shutting down its New York offices, so instead of just looking for another job in finance, I decided to strike out on my own. And parallel at the time, I also became friendly with Melissa Clark, who writes for the New York Times, and she took me under her wing, and I want to say took pity on me and had some kind of faith in me when I had absolutely zero professional cooking or writing experience. And she took me on as her interim assistant and allowed me to work on a few book projects with her, the latest one being Franny's cookbook that just came out. And it was amazing, and I loved it. And, you know, some of it was as exciting as maybe testing recipes, and some of it was not as exciting as, like, going out at, you know, 15-degree weather and getting groceries for a recipe test.
No, we have to talk about those unflattering moments, though, because people don't...
Or washing piles of dishes, like,
exactly.
Piles and piles of
there's cleanliness, there's clerical. I mean, there are things that you have to do in this profession to succeed in this profession that, you know, are unspoken but should be told.
Editing a recipe to the point of delirium.
Yeah.
Writing, you know, figuring out what a good head note is, what a good chapter intro is going to contain, which for every book is going to be, of course, different. So it was really, really, it was a great educational opportunity, and I'm going to be forever grateful to Melissa for...
Well, I mean, mentorships, too, in kitchens, in restaurants. Yep.
And I always idolized Melissa from college. Yeah. I was reading her column thinking, this person's amazing, and she's such a great writer. And then I was
so did you contact her, or was it just a felicitous meeting?
We followed each other on Twitter, like eons ago, when I guess Twitter wasn't like when the Kardashians weren't on Twitter yet, when it was still like a hip new thing. And I ran into her once at the Grand Army Plaza Farmers Market, and I did something that I never ever do because I am notoriously very shy with people that I admire and respect deeply. But for whatever reason, I came up to her and I said, you're Melissa Clark and I love your work and I've been reading. And she's like, oh my God, you're Sassy Radish. And I pretty much after that didn't know what to say because I thought, oh, she knows who I am and this is the greatest day of my life. So that's how we met, and we just sort of kept in touch. And it just so happened that she needed somebody to come in right at the time when I was leaving my job. And it was like On January 31st, I came in for work for the last day in the hedge fund, and February 1st, I was at Melissa Clark's house. Like,
yeah,
that was the transition. I didn't even take a day.
Do you remember that first recipe you worked on her with?
No, because a couple months prior to that, I was helping her on a book that she was writing. So I was doing a lot of transcription for her. So after that, I was doing so much work. I was working my full-time job, the hedge fund, and then I was coming home and doing like 5 or 6 hours of transcription a night. So it's all sort of blurry.
Yeah.
But there was, you know, there was quite a grab bag of different responsibilities.
For someone who had no restaurant experience, no particular writing experience in this field, how do you thrust yourself into it? Because I also know, you know, my first introduction to you was through Andrew Scrivani.
Yes, who also has been an amazing mentor for me and a good friend.
He just goes, she's self-taught. And, you know, it's something that if you are so impassioned by it, and even going up and introducing yourself to Melissa, if
I have no idea what possessed me to do that.
But if you want to make something happen, sometimes you have to have that leap of faith again.
It's like another force guided me to it, you know. I don't know. I mean, I in my free time, however little I had and however little I have now, I always read books on different recipes, different techniques, how different food writers and bloggers and chefs, how they do things. Because there are like, you know, 50 different ways to hard boil an egg, and all of them are great. And, you know, some of them are probably not as great, but there's not one way to hard boil an egg. There's not one way to roast a chicken. There's not one particular way to, you know, make meringue. There's so many different ways that people do things, and just learning from them and learning the technique, the ingredient, the, you know, the story behind the way that they do things. To me, all those things are so interesting. So, did I just answer your question, or I answered my own question?
No, you answered a very important thing about kind of the democratic decision of things. You know, that there is no one particular way, even though there are culinary schools that teach you a foundation and you get that skill set, and that is important.
Yep.
New techniques and new ideas come off those paths, so there really is no one particular protocol or procedure to figuring this out.
And I think it's always great to keep an open mind, you know, because you're always going to learn something. First example that comes into my head was when I was helping Melissa work on the Franny's cookbook. We were testing a recipe for his frittata, and he does something very unusual. He sticks his frittata in a very low heat oven, and he cooks it for a long time, so it cooks almost like a custard. And so when you take it out, it's this delicate yolk. And most people, when they cook their frittata, I think they put it in at a pretty high heat, and then it puffs up. So it's a very different result, and you get a very different texture to it. And I think that it kind of opened my eyes a little bit, you know, just to think of a more specific example.
Cool. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back and open everybody's eyes to so many different cultures, from kimchi to the Russian pantry to artisan ice cream. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm.
Spanning the rolling hills of Vermont's Champlain Valley and easternmost Washington County, New York, 300-acre Consider Bardwell Farm was the first cheese-making co-op in Vermont, founded in 1864 by Consider Stebbins Bardwell himself. Rotational grazing on pesticide-free and fertilizer-free pastures produces the sweetest milk and the tastiest cheese. All of their cheeses are aged on the farm in their extensive system of caves.
Consider Bardwell Farm is also a big supporter of Heritage Foods USA's No Goat Left Behind program. No Goat Left Behind is a serious effort launched in 2011 by Heritage Foods USA, designed to introduce goat meat to American diners and provide a sustainable end market for dairy animals.
For more information, please visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
Welcome back to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I was still kind of humming that Consider Bardwell song when we went back
it's
on.
It's a good song.
Yeah. Here with Olga Massoff, SassyRadish.com. And, you know, the word struggle kept on coming up between your parents and cultural struggle. But, you know, there's also a struggle to kind of understand another person's culture through their food, through, you know, their heritage, their, you know, deriving their identity through that. And your first project was not a Russian cookbook, even though you have that, you know, foundation. It was something very particular.
Very specific.
Yeah.
Very, very pointed.
Yeah. Korean kimchi.
Yes.
And why?
Well, again, Melissa Clark, my patron saint of all good things, put me in touch with this woman, Lauren Chun, who owns a boutique kimchi company in New York called Mother-in-Law Kimchi, and she needed a writer. She had, at the time, which I hadn't tried her, I tried her kimchi by the time I met her, but I didn't know her product at all, and I thought her kimchi was amazing. It was really complex and had all kinds of notes that I hadn't tried in, and I've always liked kimchi, so.
And for those who don't know kimchi?
It is, okay, so kimchi is, most people know it as pickled cabbage or daikon radish that's preserved in a mix of chili pepper and salt and anchovy and small tiny pickled shrimp and a bunch of other things. But actually, kimchi is something, it's the process of fermentation. So you can kimchi anything. You can kimchi any produce, cucumbers, you can make it long-term, so like half heads of Napa cabbage and keep them in these special clay pots called the ongi. And you can also kimchi and make an instant kimchi in the summer, say with something like a cucumber. So the idea is that when in the summer, but Korea was an agrarian society before refrigeration, in the summer when you have a lot of different produce coming in, you can eat something immediately, right? You don't have to store it for a long time. But in the winter, when things get pretty cold and you basically are stuck with like tubers and meat and rice, it's exciting to have a vegetable on your plate. So that was, I think, the idea behind it. But you can pickle anything. You can kimchi anything. So that's Lauren and I met, and she asked me to come on board to be her writer. So wrote a book, came out last November, and
to great successes, great praise.
Thank you.
I mean, and to take a single subject and be, you know, the lexicon of that.
Right.
I mean, it's an intimidating thing, but it's an amazing collaborative process because you yourself are the writer, and then there is the chef or proprietor. How does that process start?
Well, I basically try to learn as much from the person that I'm working with, and also if I'm writing, you're asking more about, you know, how it goes in general, right? How I get into the inside somebody's head and sound like them. So there's a lot of listening, and there's a lot of story gathering and understanding how the person sounds and what their expertise is in. And it's a balance between telling their story, because there's always a story, and the story is just as important, I think, as the recipe itself, because you can sort of weave a nice history of the way that we are as people, and the way that people look at food, and the way that cultures historically have looked at food.
Well, I keep on thinking that a cookbook without head notes is headless, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's, well, I guess these days you'd be hard-pressed to see a cookbook without head notes. But it always made sense to me to have headnotes, not so much for, you know, you can always put a little instructional headnote if there's no, sometimes there's just no story, right? This is good, eat it, yeah. Make it. So, but sometimes it's important to say, look, this is the way, you know, be very careful when you're, you know, sourcing this particular product. You may want to go here, here, and here for it, or there's a tip or there's a technique. But it's so great to learn stories. But going back to, you know, working with chefs and working with other folks who need books written, you basically sit down with them, you get their recipes, you get their stories, you get their expertise, and you figure out the direction that they want the book to be in. So some of these books, you know, become, they're not as comprehensive, so they're not end-all be-all. So the kimchi book was never intended to be the art of fermentation, like Sandor Katz's book. And I think some folks were a little surprised. They said, well, this isn't like Sandor Katz's book. And I thought, I cannot compare myself to Sandor Katz. His knowledge base of fermentation is so vast. And that's his whole, right? That's his whole focus, or one of his major focuses. And sometimes in the case of the book that I'm writing with Mark Vergione, Iron Chef Mark Vergione, he really wanted to, and it was very important for the story of how he got to where he got to and how the restaurant survived to be told. That was a very important aspect of not just the recipes themselves, but how the recipes came to be. Because without him getting onto the Iron Chef, some of these recipes wouldn't have come out, because it changed the way that his brain was wired. It made him think a lot more creatively, and it made him a lot more fearless in the kitchen. In the case of, you know, the couple of more current cookbooks that I'm working with, that also remains to be seen how, you know, how the chef, how the primary author wants their voice to be heard. So there's a lot of listening. There's a lot of taking notes. There's a lot of taping people and transcribing what they're saying verbatim, so you can understand the turn of phrase that they tend to use. And it's just taking your own vision of the world and putting it aside, which I have no problem doing because I love learning from other people.
Well, it's not putting it aside; it's assimilating.
Well, right, but it's not. It's not your voice.
Yeah.
It's, you know, one of the best compliments I got was the first time I showed a draft of Mark's narrative, Mark Vergione's narrative, to him. He said to me, and he's not a man of many words. He's a super nice guy, but he's not, you know, he's not very loquacious. And he said to me, wow, that really sounds like me. That sounds exactly how I talk. And that was a really great thing to hear, because I slaved and agonized and lost sleep, and I was so nervous handing it to him. So the fact that he thought that it sounded like him was a good sign.
So it's like single white female in the best of way.
In the best of way. Right.
Van Leeuwen ice cream.
Yes.
Again, you know, Ben is a very particular individual, very, yes, very, you know, interesting person.
Yes, he is.
But then there's ice cream as a whole, too. Yes. How do you take a personality and a product and kind of interweave those things?
when I was writing a draft of the proposal, because I got a draft of the proposal somewhat written, and then I had to reshape it and fine-tune it. And I was working a lot with Laura O'Neill, who's one of the founders. We were just going back and forth. We did a lot of, we had a couple meetings. We did some Skype chats, which are great, right? Because you can video conference each other and be sitting in your own house if you're pressed for time. And first of all, just going back for a second, I've been obsessed with their ice cream since the first day that they went out in their truck. It just so happened, and this is like weird fate taking place, it just so happened that their very first day before they launched really formally, they were out in Battery Park City, and I had been there checking out some weird new building fair. They built this new building, and I saw this cute little yellow truck, and I walked up to it, and they had a bunch of ice creams in this beautiful vintage botanical illustrations, and I got ginger ice cream because I'd never had it before, and I thought it was such a brilliant flavor, and I love ginger, and that was the first time I had their ice cream. And so I've always loved their ice cream far above everything else because it wasn't very sweet, and I don't like overly sweet things. And I love the fact that they used ingredients that you find in your pantry. So when I heard that they wanted to speak to me about writing a book, I almost fell out of my chair. I was so excited because I was like, this is the ice cream. This is the only ice cream I really eat. This is the ice cream I really love. So for me, it's such an honor to work with them. And they have a really great story to tell because they really stuck to their guns in that they were not putting, you know, gums and stabilizers in their ice cream. They were not putting milk powder in their ice cream. They were going to use, you know, the best ingredients that they could source. You know, the pistachios that they source come from Sicily and they're hand harvested every 2 years. And I loved the fact that they were so dedicated and passionate, and they were very young when they were starting that business. I mean, they're still very young, but that kind of commitment and that passion, it's a beautiful story. I think it's going to be a very easy story to tell.
Well, I mean, even with you having loved their ice cream before this moment happened, how important is it to be invested in a project? You have to like not only what you're doing, but what you're doing it for.
Right. Well, I've been very lucky. I've worked thus far with supremely nice people, and you know, every once in a while you read an article about a horror story someone had working on a book with someone or working on a project, and I don't have that yet because I've been just so blessed with working with really lovely people. And the way that I see it is everybody's approach and everybody's viewpoint and everybody's way of doing things is interesting, and it's yet another way for me to learn a different take on things. So I find it to be always very exciting. I don't know, maybe because I'm still wide-eyed and bushy-tailed about it. No, you know, I just haven't been been jaded about that. But I find all the projects that I'm working with to be fascinating. I'm working on a book with Mark Murphy now, who's a judge on Chopped and who's a bunch of restaurants in New York, and he's just got so many great ideas and he's got so much energy, and his story is absolutely amazing. He grew up in Europe and, you know, he watched his grandparents in France cook, and the way that his world was shaped was very different. He moved around so much too that he really, when he cooks, he brings all these different ingredients and elements and techniques with the dishes that he makes.
So I know you're saying you're taking on someone else's voice when you write these books, but I want to hear yours. Because I know from your Instagram feed, from other social media.
Mostly of cats.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about cats at the end. Like the kitchen sink, there are often these amassed dishes, and I want to know what's been going on in your kitchen, lady. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur coming up. You must have your spin on dishes.
I was trying to make brisket last night, overnight brisket, and our carbon monoxide detector went off at 1 o'clock in the morning. So I have a half cooked brisket in my fridge. There was a lot of
Miqui.
Yes, there was a lot of refrigerator Tetris at 1 o'clock in the morning, which I'm not very good at when I'm in deep sleep or just been woken out of deep sleep. And so Rosh Hashanah prep testing recipes for Mark Murphy's book. So there's a lot of that. So that's what's been going on in the kitchen. I think I took a picture of I was making a dessert. I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about individual dishes for the book, but it was a dessert and it involved five bowls. And I thought, oh, good God. And so I took a look at my sink with five bowls and all of them messy. And I thought, that's a story. It's a vignette. It's a little story. It's a picture.
What are those little dolls that fit inside the dolls?
The Matryoshka dolls?
Yeah. You just need Matryoshka dishes. Bowls.
I do. Yeah. Just bowl. Yeah. And yeah, the number of bowls I have in the kitchen is mind boggling. So so sometimes it's, I'm really fascinated with perfectly styled things, but I really like messes. I like the way plates and tables look after people have finished tearing through their meat or food or vegetable. And you have these sort of very barbaric looking, you know, top down shots, or you know, what a kitchen looks like after you've tested 8 recipes in one day.
Uh-huh.
And it's not pretty. You have to, like, take, you know, steel wool pretty much to get some of the grease off.
Well, then, what are the recipes you cook for yourself? What are your comforts? Are they from your Russian heritage? Are they from, you know, your newfound global cuisine?
Some yes, some no. What do I cook as a comfort food? Well, for me, nothing beats a big pot of mashed potatoes.
Oh, I thought you were going to say nothing beats. I'm done with borscht. I'm done with all that.
Oh, no, never. Never. I will never be done with beets or borscht or herring or any of those things. So, yes, those are comfort foods in some ways. But I used to, I had a roommate when I first moved to New York who was South Indian, and one of her big comfort meals was basmati rice with yogurt and lime pickle. And so I will make that for myself if I'm just feeling really crappy about the world and I just want some comfort, and or I make a big bowl of mashed potatoes or big pot of mashed potatoes and I proceed to eat the whole pot. But Nora Ephron wrote so eloquently about mashed potatoes in her book Heartburn that when I read it, I thought, wow, there's somebody else out there who had the same worldview of mashed potatoes that I mean, she really thought it would, like, it could take care of a bad day, and that's how I feel about them.
Actually, I want to get your mashed potato recipe then, being that there are 50 ways to hard-boil an egg. What is your way to mash potatoes?
I don't really have a way, per se. Everything needs to be warm when you combine it. So, butter has to be melted and warm. Milk has to be melted and warm. I do like to add some cream to it. When my husband wants to eat some mashed potatoes, I don't put cream in it because it will kill him. He is sensitive to that. But I basically try to whip it really quickly. And for some reason, I always wind up doing it by hand just because time is of the essence. But you don't want to stir it too much because then it gets too gluey, and instead of like airy and light and wonderful, it becomes heavy and the opposite of what you want in mashed potatoes. Aside from the fact that you just put like your entire day's worth of calories in it, but we're talking about comfort, right?
And it
shows. You can't put a caloric value on comfort. So,
Joe, can we make sure we pull quote that you can't put the caloric value on comfort?
No. Priceless and precious. I don't think there's like a method. And sometimes I'll throw in some caramelized onions if I have some lying in the fridge. And sometimes I have some roasted garlic and that goes in. I went through a phase where I made a lot of wasabi mashed potatoes because I couldn't get enough of wasabi. They were green mashed potatoes. So there was a lot of that. But I don't know if there's a method. Just good starchy potato.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing, like no red bliss potatoes, those wouldn't be good.
So now I want to talk about cat food really quickly. It's a weird diversion, but you and I both have cats.
Obsessed with our cats.
A little too much so. We both have hashtags for our cats.
Yep.
And they are, from what it seems, hearty eaters.
Yeah. Well, our cat isn't that big of an eater. That's the weird. I think he's just, we joke, my husband and I joke that he is built like a linebacker. If there was ever a cat in a NFL draft, he'd totally be in the first pick. And so I think your cat, because you told me.
Oh, well, if you need O-line, he'll protect your blind side.
He'd be great. I think we should start putting together a team. But no, he doesn't eat that much, but he somehow became very spoiled with whenever I'm cooking like chicken or fish or meat, he always gets a little nibble because he loves that stuff. And so, so we've created a monster.
To be a cat in your house.
And water from a human glass held
for
him. He won't drink it if you put it on the floor. You have to hold it for him.
They're so specific. Well, back to not cats.
Yes.
Back to not my cats. Congratulations. I mean,
this
has been, an amazing adventure for you. And this is just the beginning. This is just
it's
the
been amazing.
You know,
I feel very fortunate. I feel very lucky. I'm very grateful for everybody who's ever given me an opportunity or a chance. And
just watch out when you go to, the green market. Now you have people approach you.
Okay.
You have to don that same, attitude mentorship to them.
I mean, the few people that have approached me for advice, I always go, I don't know if I have any advice to give. But I mean, I try to be as helpful as an informative and honest, because it's not an easy life. I mean, I work a PR job about 35 hours a week, which is almost like a full-time job, and I'm working on 3 cookbooks right now, so it's not easy. but it is, if you love it, it's totally worth it.
Well, you can forward all those inquiries on to heritageradionetwork.org because absolutely. Now we have 40 minutes of advice for people straight from the source. Olga Masoff, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And if you've never gone to sassyradish.com, make it part of your everyday life.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Looking forward to having you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.